title of the talk is Loving the Buddha, Seeing the Dharma.
So there was once a young Brahmin named Vakali, who lived in the great city of Sarvati. And he came from a good family, and he became learned in the three Vedas. He became a Brahmin priest. And one day, and we're not sure of the circumstances, he encountered the Buddha. The Buddha spent a lot of his time in Sarvati, and Vakali came across him. The Buddha might have been begging his one meal a day, and Vakali saw him on the streets of Sarvati, or he might have been giving a Dhamma talk, or the Buddha might have just been sitting quietly. We don't know, but what we do know is that as soon as Vakali saw the Buddha, he just wanted to be with him all the time. It was as if he fell in love with the Buddha. Well, the Buddha was just so incredibly impressive, so handsome, so beautiful, so dignified, his whole being radiating mindfulness, self-possession, and loving kindness. And with that quality of mysteriousness and fascination. And Vakali was so smitten with the Buddha that he just wanted to be with him all the time. And he realised the only way he could do that was to become a monk, to become a bhikshu. So he became a bhikkhu, he was ordained, just so that he could be with the Buddha all the time, just so that he could look at the Buddha all the time. And that's what he did. He just spent as much time as possible dwelling near the Buddha, looking at him, gazing at him, contemplating him, taking darshan from him, as the Indian idiom has it even now. And the only breaks he took from gazing on the Buddha was to go and beg his food and eat it, and when he bathed, and presumably when he went to the toilet as well. They were the only breaks he had from just looking at the Buddha. He just stayed close to the Buddha, looking at him, gazing at him with uninterrupted love and devotion. And it was possible because it seems when Vakali became a monk, it was the long rainy season retreat, and the Buddha was in one place, in the Jetta Grove, in Anatta Pindika's park, so Vakali could just stay close and just gaze with loving devotion on the Buddha. And of course the Buddha noticed this. He noticed this bhikkhu, this monk, who was always around, always looking at him with undisguised love and devotion. And at a certain point, the Buddha said to Vakali, "Vakali, what are you looking for in this decaying body? He who sees the Dhamma sees me. He who sees me sees the Dhamma." Just said that. Just this pithy verse directing Vakali away from a preoccupation with the Buddha's, his own visible form, his own appearance, directing Vakali to the Dhamma, to seeing, to experiencing the Dhamma. So Vakali did stop looking at the Buddha's visible form, but he stayed near, contemplating the Buddha, recollecting the Buddha in his mind, but making sure he was near to the Buddha all the time. So he continued to dwell as close as he possibly could to the Buddha. But then, when the rainy season retreat was coming to an end, when it was time for the monks to disperse on their various wanderings, Vakali received a rude shock. The Buddha told him that he had to leave, that he could not stay with him. He just said, "Go, Vakali, go. You can't stay with me." There was, and it was clear from the way the Buddha spoke, that there was to be no discussion, no reporting in about it. He just had to go. It was a clear command. The teacher had spoken. And Vakali was very, very upset. He felt really terrible. What had he done? Why couldn't he stay close to his teacher, his spiritual friend? Why couldn't he stay near to the Buddha, to the fount of all blessings, all quality, to the Bhagavan, the one rich in spiritual qualities, the supreme spiritual object, the focus of all his faith and devotion? Why couldn't he stay with him? Why did he have to go? And there's the rub, of course. The teacher you love has told you to go. So that's all you can do. So Vakali just wandered off. Wandered to Rajagaha, to the Gridrakuta mountain, the vulture's peak, to its peaks and its caves and to its forested slopes. And he was really deeply upset, deeply grieving. What is life to me if I cannot see him? What is life to me if I cannot see him? It's like a lover talking about the lost beloved. There's that intensity of devotion, of attachment. And somehow the Buddha knew what was going on for Vakali. And of course the Buddha was deeply concerned for him. On the one hand, the Buddha knew that if Vakali was to break through to wisdom, to enlightenment, he had to renounce his attachment to him, to the Buddha. On the other hand, Vakali was so upset at being parted, the Buddha was concerned that Vakali, in his grief, might do damage to himself. So the Buddha came to Vakali, dwelling there on the vulture's peak, and gave him special teaching, special instructions in meditation, and then said, "The bhikkhu who is full of joy and happy in the instruction of the Buddha will attain to the state of peace, nirvana, to the blissful allaying of all mundane conditions." And Vakali was inspired at this and got down to serious spiritual practice, to intensive meditation in the caves on the vulture's peak and in the forest groves at its base. He dwelt for the most part alone, deep in the forest, although there were, it seems, other monks, other groups of monks around practicing, all seriously intent on their spiritual practice. And Vakali was very assiduous. He was very intense in his practice, and he practiced very hard. And it seems that he went without food or just relied on very little food. He seems to have dwelt far away from places where he could beg his food, deep in the forest. The main thing was to practice intensively, to follow the instruction of the teacher. And we get a sense of his practice because a little later, the Buddha came to Vakali and he could see that Vakali was struggling and in some pain. And the Buddha said, "Stricken by sharp stomach pains, you monk, dwelling in the forest grove, where it is harsh and hard to get food, what will you do?" And Vakali replied, "Flooding the body with abundant rapture and bliss, and enduring what is harsh, I shall dwell in the grove. Developing the bases of mindfulness, the faculties, the powers, and the factors of enlightenment, I shall dwell in the grove. Recollecting men who are resolute, who put forth energy, constantly firm in their effort, who are harmonious and united, I shall dwell in the grove. Recollecting the perfect Buddha, the foremost, the self-tamed, the perfectly composed and concentrated, with untiring effort, both day and night, I shall dwell in the grove." So this is how Vakali practiced. With joyful, blissful effort, recollecting the Sangha, his brothers in the Sangha, and the Buddha, developing the different aspects of the path, the different qualities of the path. And we're not sure how long he was in retreat, weeks, months, years, but it's clear that he made great progress along the path. And at some point he left his retreat and with some friends, some other monks, went to see the Buddha, who was dwelling high up on the vulture's peak. He was obviously in the forests and he was going to go on the road to the vulture's peak. And on the journey there, Vakali fell ill, very seriously ill. He was stricken with sharp pains. So much so that he just couldn't continue on his journey to see the Buddha. He was so ill, his friends found a hut of a poor potter, a very low community in India, poor, very simple hut, and they asked if Vakali could be housed there, a hut by the side of the road. And here they were able to make Vakali comfortable and a bed on the ground. And Vakali was very, very weak, very, very sick. In fact, he felt that he didn't have long to live. So he said to his friends, "Please, go to the Buddha. Pay homage to him in my name by bowing down to him. Tell him that I'm seriously ill and ask him if, out of compassion, he could come to see me." So some of those monks, friends of Vakali, went to the Buddha and asked him if he would come. And the Buddha, as he always used to do, consented by remaining silent. The Buddha left the vulture's peak and made his way to the poor and simple dwelling of the potter, where Vakali was lying seriously, gravely ill. And when Vakali saw that the Buddha was approaching, he immediately stirred on his bed, immediately tried to get up to pay his respects, to bow to the Buddha, but he was too weak and he was in too much pain. And the Buddha immediately put Vakali at his ease, telling him that there was no need to rise, that there was a seat ready for him. The Buddha sat down beside Vakali's bed in the poor potter's hut, putting Vakali at his ease. And the Buddha asked Vakali, "I hope you are well, Vakali. I hope you are bearing up, Vakali. I hope that your pain is passing, that it's not increasing." And Vakali had to reply, "I am not well, Bhante. I am not bearing up. I am not improving. I am not getting better. And the pain is not lessening. The pain is getting worse." So Vakali is in a very, very sorry state indeed. And the Buddha wants to know more. He wants to know about Vakali's spiritual state. The Buddha is, after all, Vakali's spiritual friend and teacher. He wants to know what sort of spiritual state Vakali is in. So he asked, "Vakali, I hope you are not troubled by remorse and regret." This is a very important question. Vakali is sick. He's facing death. His situation physically is seemingly helpless. The Buddha wants to know if he's facing that with serenity, with clarity, without any bad feelings, any remorse as to his behaviour. And Vakali, sadly, has to reply, "Bhante, I am troubled. I'm troubled by remorse and regret." He's not only physically very ill, mentally, spiritually, he's troubled as well. And the Buddha probes further, and we have to imagine the Buddha's compassion, his sensitivity, his tenderness, and his wisdom too as he does this. "Well, Vakali, are you remorseful because you have something to reproach yourself for because of your ethics? Have you broken your precepts?" And Vakali said, "No, I have done nothing that I need to reproach myself in relation to the precepts." So he's got a clear conscience. And the Buddha is puzzled by this, saying, "Well, if there is nothing you are ashamed of, then why this remorse? Why this regret? Why are you so troubled?" "I am regretful. I am troubled. Because for a long time, I have wanted to see you, Bhagava, Blessed One, but I have not been well enough to do so." To which the Buddha replied with that precept, that teaching that he'd given to Vakali when he was a young monk, probably many years before, "Hush now, Vakali. What is there to see in this decaying body? He who sees the Dhamma sees me. He who sees me sees the Dhamma. Truly seeing the Dhamma, Vakali, he sees me. And in seeing me, He sees the Dhamma. Then the Buddha went on deeper into the Dhamma, asking Vakkali if each of the five skandhas, form, feelings, perception, volitions, consciousness, are they impermanent? Are they unsatisfactory? Are they without essence? And to each of these questions, Vakkali replied that all of them, his whole psychophysical organism, the whole of existence, all things were impermanent, unsatisfactory, and without essence, anicca, dukkha, anatta. And the Buddha added that a man who sees all things in this way, who understands that all things are like this, such a man goes beyond, completely beyond any state of conditioned existence. Such a man is enlightened. Such a man is liberated. And after giving this teaching, after comforting and exhorting Vakkali in this way, the Buddha left the potter's hut, left Vakkali, and returned to the vulture's peak. Not long after the Buddha had left, Vakkali said to his friends, "Come on, friends, lift me up from my bed and carry me to the black rock on the Isigili slope. How can one who has gone forth think of dying in a house?" Vakkali knew he was dying and didn't want to die in a home, even if it was just a poor man's hut. He was a wanderer without a hut. He'd renounced the world, so he wanted to die out in the open on the mountainside. So his friends took him to that place. No doubt they sat with him, they meditated with him, and during the night strange things happened around the vulture's peak, around this slope. Just before dawn, two devas, two gods of stunning beauty, approached the Buddha, lit up the whole of the vulture's peak with strange unearthly lights. And one of them said to the Buddha, "Bhante, the bhikkhu, the monk, Vakkali, is intent on liberation from conditioned existence." And the other deva said, "Surely, Bhante, he will be liberated. He will be well liberated." And after speaking to the Buddha in this way, they vanished. And when the morning came, the Buddha sent some of his monks to Vakkali with a message. And when they came to the dying Vakkali, those monks told Vakkali that they had a message from the Buddha. And Vakkali immediately left his bed to sit on the ground, though it gave him much pain, explaining that it was not fitting to hear a message from the teacher whilst lying down. And those monks told Vakkali what the Buddha had said, that two devas had come in the night, two devas of stunning beauty, and they had said that Vakkali would be well liberated. "So do not be afraid, Vakkali. Do not be afraid. Your death will not be a bad one. Your passing will not be a bad one." And in response, Vakkali asked those monks to go back to the Buddha and pay homage to him in Vakkali's name and tell the Buddha, "Form is impermanent. I have no doubt about that. All the skandhas are impermanent. I have no doubt about that. Tell him that I have no doubt that whatever is impermanent is suffering, and I have no doubt that I have no more desire, no more craving and grasping for what is suffering and subject to change." So the monks left Vakkali and went to the Buddha to deliver Vakkali's message. In fact, Vakkali dismissed all the monks around him. He was in severe, overwhelming pain. His body was completely wrecked and wasted. And without any attachment, without any aversion, without any impulsiveness, he took hold of a knife and took his own life. And soon word of this reached the Buddha. And he went with a party of monks to see Vakali lying there, having taken the knife, lying there dead. And as the Buddha and the monks sat with the dead body, there appeared in the sky a cloud of smoke, a swirl of darkness. It moved to the east, then to the west, to the north, to the south, upwards and downwards. It moved in all directions. And the Buddha said to the monks, "Do you see that smoke, that swirl of darkness, monks? That is Mara, the evil one, searching for Vakali's consciousness. Mara is wondering where it has gone, but he will never find that consciousness, for Vakali's consciousness does not abide anywhere in conditioned existence. The brother Vakali has attained final nirvana." So this is the story of Vakali, which I've put together from various parts of Pali literature, Sutta literature and commentarial literature. And what I want to do for the rest of this talk is to explore various themes in this story that relate to the title of the talk, from loving the Buddha to seeing the Dhamma. So theme number one, Vakali's love of the Buddha. So Vakali loves the Buddha. Seeing the Buddha, he felt an immediate, strong, powerful attraction. So strong indeed that he couldn't bear to be apart from the Buddha. He wanted to be with him all the time, and that meant he had to become a monk, a bhikkhu. That was the only way to be with the Buddha all of the time. Now, it wasn't actually unusual for people to be so attracted to the person of the Buddha, to his immediate appearance, to experience such strong love and devotion. The Buddha did seem to, you know, for many people, have this fascinating quality, this sort of magnetic quality. He didn't just draw people into the Dharma through his teaching. There was also this incredible presence, his person, his being, his behaviour, that attracted people very strongly. And it was that, as much as his teaching, probably more than his teaching, that drew people to him. In fact, so much was this the case that certainly in the early days of his teaching career, he was accused of luring young men away from home by using magic. He was that sort of effective in having a following of men. But of course it wasn't like that. It was true that the Buddha was probably a very handsome and dignified man. He came from a warrior, princely family. But of course there was more to it than that. There were his spiritual qualities shining through, and that mysterious quality that you could not get hold of that drew people on. So the Buddha was very attractive. And Vakali was completely smitten by the Buddha. He had a particularly strong feeling for the Buddha. Now we might smile at the young Vakali. He seems so naive, so over the top, that he cannot bear to be apart from the Buddha. But the fact is, we're in no position to adopt a superior attitude in relation to somebody like Vakali, because we're nowhere near to having such a strong love for the Buddha, such a strong emotional response to the Buddha. The vast majority of people struggle to have a strong emotional response to the Buddha, indeed to the Dhamma, and indeed to the Sangha. They don't really love these three most precious jewels. And because they don't love them, don't see them as the most lovely, the most beautiful things in life, they make very little spiritual progress. Vakali's love for the Buddha leads him, impels him to leave home, to give up worldly life completely. His love impels him to be with the Buddha all the time. And that means giving everything up, everything. If we want to know how deep, how strong our love is for the Buddha, for the Dharma, for the Sangha, we need to see what we have given up to enable us to be with the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And we might conclude that it isn't very much. What we have to let go of, we need to see what we have. We need to see what we have to let go of, so that we can be more fully with the three jewels. Sometimes you hear people complaining of how long it takes to get ordained. Well, wasn't it quicker in the old days, Padmavajra? You know, you say you got ordained within 2 years on a weekend retreat. Well, it can still be quick. But that depends on how much you want to be with the three jewels. How much you're prepared to give up. How much you're prepared to change to be with those jewels. So we need a strong, deep, emotional response to the Buddha. We need to love the Buddha. Recently, Bhante and Subhuti have been encouraging us to reimagine the Buddha, to have a vivid sense of the Buddha's presence in our lives. And there are quite a lot of discussions going on about this important topic. Discussions, paradoxically, that can get rather heady about the nature of the imagination. What does it mean to imagine? How do we imagine? What's the imagination? But the answer is actually really very, very simple. You imagine what you love. You imagine what you desire. If you want an indication of where your meditation is at, where your imagination is at, if you spend a meditation having lurid sexual fantasies, that's an indicator of where your imagination is at, and where your desires are at, and where your love is at. You imagine what you love. You imagine what you desire. You respond to an image, a symbol, a person, even, because they touch you deeply, because it elicits in you a deep longing. If you cannot imagine the Buddha, it's because you don't love the Buddha. You don't desire to be with the Buddha. It really is that simple. The images, the symbols, the archetypes of enlightenment, the Buddha, the Buddhas, the Bodhisattvas, arise out of love. They arise out of deep longing to connect with, to experience, to be touched by the living presence of enlightenment. That's where these images come from. Earlier generations of Buddhists didn't want to just think about enlightenment, to have ideas about enlightenment. They wanted it to be alive for them. They wanted it to live with them. They wanted to be in touch with it as they would be with an enlightened person, the living Buddha. During the Buddha's own lifetime, even the great disciples like Sariputta felt that they wanted to be with the Buddha. They'd recollect the Buddha when they were apart from the Buddha. They spiritually needed to feel connected with the living example of Buddhahood. Their love, their devotion to the Buddha brought him close to them in their imagination, even though he was far away. Of course they did this. Of course they lived like this, but because it's the most natural thing for human beings to do. You know, when we have friends, when we're apart from our friends, we naturally bring them to mind, even though they're not there. And of course, in the Buddha's case, we're talking about bringing to mind the supreme spiritual friend. After the Buddha's parinirvana, the disciples of the Buddha continue to long to be in the presence of the Buddha. And that longing manifested in different ways. It manifested in the worship of stupas containing relics of the Buddha. In some way, people felt connected with the living presence of the Buddha by being with the stupas. It took the form in visual art with symbols of the Buddha, like the Dharma Chakra, the Sripada, the footprints of the Buddha, and eventually, of course, the emergence of the Buddha image itself and all the different archetypal forms, the different Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, with all their colours and so on. And some of these forms, of course, are very different in appearance than the Buddha himself, with all these different colours and symbols and implements and so on. But they're all coming out of this deep longing to be in, with the living presence of enlightenment. Not to just think about enlightenment, not to have a conception of enlightenment, not to be have an abstract idea of enlightenment, but to be in touch with the living presence, the living form of enlightenment. Here in the modern West, we're in a very different world. We still, if we're serious about the Dharma, we still have to contact that deep longing for enlightenment. We still need to develop that deep love for enlightenment. And out of that love and longing, we will begin to see enlightenment. The living presence of enlightenment will start to come towards us. What it will look like, who it might look like, we don't know in the long run. We have a starting point in Eastern Buddhist art and iconography, but that's only a beginning. What we're going to need to do is to reach down into our deepest, most heartfelt longing for the beyond. What will then emerge? So, second theme, the Buddha sending Vakali away. Although Vakali has a strong emotional, devotional response to the Buddha, a response that we can and should admire, in Vakali's case, it's one-sided. It's unbalanced. That love, that keen, direct, natural response to the Buddha's beauty may have drawn him into the influence of the Buddha, in that sense drawn him into the Dharma. But if he's to go further, he'll have to develop other qualities. His love, his devotion, is too attached to the Buddha's person. And that is preventing him from seeing the deeper meaning of the Buddha. Vakali is also too dependent on the Buddha. If he's to progress, he will need to develop the qualities that lead to Buddhahood, independently of the Buddha. You know, we know how important external conditions are to support our practice, especially having spiritual friends. But we also need to be developing qualities within ourselves, hence the importance of things like solitary retreats. And the Buddha is very skillful with Vakali. He doesn't just send him away. At first he doesn't do that. He doesn't even try to psychoanalyze what's going on for Vakali. He doesn't converse with him, as far as we know. You know, if the Buddha had tried to talk to Vakali, Vakali would have probably freaked out. It would have been too much. He was so in awe of the Buddha. First, the Buddha just says a sort of pithy precept. What is there to see in this decaying body, Vakali? He who sees the Dhamma sees me. He who sees me sees the Dhamma. Just that. And it seems Vakali gets the point a bit, because he does withdraw a little from the Buddha, but he's still spending much of his time dwelling on the Buddha and dwelling near the Buddha. What the Buddha wants, of course, in this saying, is for Vakali to make the Dhamma a direct living experience within himself, a continuous experience that will never leave him. He wants Vakali to follow the path to insight, to wisdom, to become the refuge himself, rather than on relying on him externally. To do this, Vakali will have to take much more individual responsibility, much more responsibility for himself. In another way of putting it, the Buddha is urging Vakali to move from being a bhakta, a devotee, to being a shishya, a disciple. I remember in India, Bhante, many, many, many years ago, Bhante giving a talk to thousands of people talking about the distinction between admiring the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha and committing, going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. And he said, you know, you sometimes hear Indian teachers, they might say, I have thousands, I have a lakh, that's 100,000 devotees. That means people, bhaktas, people who admire me, who are devoted to me. I have only two disciples, two people fully committed to following the path that I teach, fully, completely. So to go for refuge means becoming a disciple, becoming committed to the path. And I must say, I think I'm attracted to this aspect of Vakali's life because of my own experience. I was first involved, as Sataloka said, when I was 17. I was ordained when I was 19. My response to the Dharma was immediate. I loved it immediately. I love the Dharma. I love the Sangha. I love the Buddha. I love Bhante. I loved order members. I thought all order members with those fantastic names, they must be bodhisattvas. Which, you know, was a bit disturbing for some of them to be around that. A bit much for them. I especially loved energetic and inspired order members. And it was a very genuine, inspired response. But it had a downside. And the downside was a certain passivity. The downside was an unthinking passivity and not really taking full responsibility for myself, being too dependent on the external. And sometimes Bhante seemed really quite tough in response to that in relation to me. When I was in that sort of passive, sort of admiring, you know, give me the Dharma sort of state, he just ignored me. I mean, literally, he would ignore me. I'd go over to him and he'd just turn away and look really bored, really bored. Which was quite disturbing. But it was a good lesson, a good teaching. Never explained it to me, and we've never talked about it. We never had a sort of session about it or anything like that. And the message became very clear. Or in India, I remember in particular, and I've told this story before, when Bhante returned to India after being away for many years, it was amazing being in the midst of this, him teaching the Dharma to all these people and the tremendous devotion, tremendous atmosphere that was around. And, you know, Indians really know how to do it with garlands and flowers and, you know, and I was sort of Bhante's, you know, sort of attendant, which is fantastic. You know, and I'd gather up his garlands after a talk and put his sandals on and we'd go through the crowds and, you know, we'd get back home and, you know, hang up garlands everywhere and there'd be this wonderful smell of jasmine and it was fantastic. And I was so moved one night after I'd put up his mosquito net and given him his nighttime drink. And I was overcome and I had to say something. And I said, Bhante, I don't know what I will do if you die. And he said, that's assuming I die first. And it was really throwing me back on myself. Really throwing me back. Gave me a lot to think about. And actually, recently when I was looking at my relationship to Bhante and looking through old correspondence, the message, time and time again, is him throwing me back on myself. Make your own decisions. Live from yourself. I have faith in you to make your own decisions. Again and again and again. And I'm very grateful to Bhante for that. They were tough lessons sometimes. Very tough, very puzzling. But they were really invaluable lessons, which I try to remember on a daily basis. Never allowing me to just follow along. Vakali needed very strong medicine. Because at the end of the rainy season retreat, you remember, the Buddha just told him to go. Just go. Right away. He didn't even tell him what to do. Just go. He's got to work it out. So the next theme. Vakali's practice in the forest and on the peaks around the Vulture's Peak. So Vakali leaves the Buddha, and we're told that he wanders off to Rajagaha, to the Vulture's Peak, and to the caves around it and the other peaks and the jungles at its base. And the jungles in those days would have been very, very dense around there. They're not like that now. And of course, it's a very, very painful time for him. He's filled with grief at being parted from the Buddha. And he's probably feeling really baffled, confused about what's happening. Even he's probably feeling humiliated at being told to go so unceremoniously. And probably word has got round. You heard what's gone on about Vakali. He's been told to go. Wow, you know what he was like, you know. All that devotion, you know, he had it coming, really. So, you know, he's come to the Dharma, he's come to the Buddha. And he's come to it in a particular way. That's got him somewhere. But inevitably, we take hold of the Dharma. He's taken hold of the Dharma only sort of partially. And his teacher, who he loves, the man he most loves, most reveres, has revealed the limitations of how he's got hold of the Dharma. And therefore, the limitations of his practice, the limitations of his grasp of the Dharma, as even pointed out his own limitations by sending him away. He's doing that in order to break a habit that Vakali has got into. Sometimes it's like that for us. In fact, it's going to be inevitable for us. We come to the Dharma. We even ask for ordination. We enter the training. We get ordained. We're an order member for some years, even many years. But our practice and our spiritual friends reveal our limitations, reveal the limitations even of our vision of the Dharma, of the Buddha. We think we know what it is. We've only got hold of a very, very small bit of it. And that is probably a bit distorted. It gets us some way, but there's a long, long way to go. And we have to take a new line, follow a new line. And of course, sometimes when this happens before people realise what's really happening, people react to this. They blame the Dharma. They blame Buddhism. They blame the Sangha. They blame their spiritual friends for letting them down. But the truth is, it's their own limitations that are being revealed. Vakali doesn't react like this. He takes responsibility. It's extremely painful, but he takes responsibility. He doesn't blame the Buddha for sending him away. And in doing this, in taking responsibility, Vakali begins to move from bhakta, devotee, to shisha, disciple. He moves from being a man of devotion, bhakti, to a man of faith, sadha. Faith is much deeper than devotion. When sadha arises, it means that as well as there being a deep love and devotion for the Buddha, there is something else. There is a direct and vivid sense that you can follow the path to Buddhahood yourself. You can become the Buddha yourself. Vakali became famous, in fact, for his faith, for his sadha. Later on, the Buddha described him as the chief, the foremost of his disciples who are inclined to faith, who have the courage of faith, who are naturally faithful. He also tells another disciple that Vakali is one of those who was liberated, who was enlightened through faith. Vakali's faith impelled him, moved him, inspired him along the path to Buddhahood itself. And we can gain some insight into Vakali's practice in the forests around the Vulture's Peak, in that verse that Vakali sings to the Buddha when the Buddha asks him how he will practice when he is filled with sharp pains. First, Vakali says, flooding the body with abundant rapture and bliss, and enduring what is harsh, I shall dwell in the grove. The body here is not just the physical body, it's the mind body, it's the spiritual body. He floods himself with abundant rapture and bliss, piti and sukha. And rapture and bliss arise from his faith, from his pure behaviour, from his skillfulness. Pleasure, great pleasure, arises from those states, from those qualities. Things might be harsh, they might be painful, but if you make sadha, faith, ethics, skillfulness, central to you, rapture and bliss will flood your being. You will enter dhyana, absorption, which is essential for further spiritual progress, even though you might be struggling physically. In the second verse, Vakali mentions developing the four bases of mindfulness, the five spiritual faculties, the five powers, and the seven factors of enlightenment. In other words, he's developing the qualities of the Dhamma necessary to attain Buddhahood. Perhaps it's especially worth noticing the five faculties, which become, of course, the five powers, because these indicate all-round, balanced development, faith and wisdom, effort and meditation, all balanced by mindfulness. A rounded spiritual life, Vakali is now practice. Vakali is strong in faith, but that all needs to be rounded out, and he's doing that. I remember Bhante saying in a seminar with the Mitra conveners a few years back that he thought it was really important that we develop all-round spiritual qualities. It's important to be an all-rounder in that sense, so that we're not one-sided and distorted. In his third verse, Vakali recollects the Sangha, his spiritual friends. These are probably his monk friends who are in the forest with him, nearby, in retreat, making effort, and they're in harmony. They have unity because they're really giving themselves to their spiritual practice. This is important too, that Vakali recollects his spiritual friends. He's not just recollecting the Buddha, the great teacher. He recollects his peers, his fellows, his brothers in the Sangha. If we're just relating to the teacher, if there's just devotion to the teacher, that makes you one-sided. You can end up thinking that you're special, the special one, the special disciple. You know, just as much as if you fancy yourself as being a great teacher. You know, there's going to be conceit there. But Vakali is happy to be part of the Sangha, the brotherhood, practicing with them, with energy and commitment, in full harmony. In the final verse, Vakali says that he recollects the perfect Buddha, and he recalls his qualities. He mentions some of them, that the Buddha is the foremost man, the highest one, highest man, the one who's tamed himself. He's worked on himself. You know, he acknowledges that the Buddha, you know, hasn't just dropped from heaven as a god, but he's become a Buddha through his efforts, and he's fully composed and concentrated, naturally concentrated. So there's a constant sense of the Buddha being with him, being by him, and those qualities perfume Vakali. It's said when you do recollection of the Buddha practice properly, your body becomes like a shrine room. So there's a sort of path that Vakali describes. First of all, there's absorption, deep meditation, dhyana, arising from faith and ethics. Secondly, there's dwelling on the Dharma teaching. Thirdly, there's recollecting the Sangha, opening out to the Sangha. And fourthly, there's opening up to the Buddha, the transcendental dimension. The fourth theme is Vakali's final meeting with the Buddha. What I particularly want to concentrate on here is the Buddha's famous saying to Vakali, "What is there to see in this decaying body? He who sees the Dhamma sees me. He who sees me sees the Dhamma." We need to feel the full force of this teaching to Vakali, Because of his love for the Buddha, because of his faith in the Buddha, Vakali has made great spiritual progress. He's right on the edge, if you like, of nirvana, but the Buddha wants him to look deeper, he wants him to see deeper, he wants him to go deeper. And when the Buddha tells Vakali to see the Dhamma, what he's really doing is urging Vakali to see the real nature of the Buddha. He's not, I feel, telling him to concentrate on the teaching, to think about Dhamma categories, or even, in a sense, to practice the Dhamma. Later on, he does give thorough instruction, questioning on the nature of the skandhas, on all things. He does do that, pointing out their impermanent, unsatisfactory, and empty essence, or rather asking Vakali, is that the case? But it's really that powerful verse that's important. It's really a pointing to the true nature of the Buddha, which is the Dhamma in the sense of the truth, of reality, vast, inconceivable, unfathomable. In other suttas where the Buddha is asked about his true nature himself, the Buddha says he neither exists nor not exists, or exists or not exists together, or neither. But then he uses an image to describe that. He says the Tathagata here and now is like the ocean. Like the ocean. And you know, you can read that. Yeah, it's like the ocean. Big bit of sea, you know. But wait a minute. For Indians in the Ganges Valley, they'd never seen the ocean. The ocean is this mythical symbol, this legendary realm, vast, endless body of water, very, very deep body of water, of which strange stories are told, filled with strange creatures and strange treasures. What the Buddha is saying when he says he's like the ocean, and indeed he says the Dhamma is like the ocean in one place, is trying to evoke his deep mystery. Or the Buddha says he's not to be known in the same way that you can't tell where a fire's gone when it's extinguished. And of course, with our modern scientific notions, we think, yeah, well, the fire's just gone out because it's run out of fuel, so it's not there. But ancient Indian notions of fire is that the material, the combustible material, and what ignites it are only the visible aspects of making flame. There is also the subtle element of fire, which is activated by those conditions. So when the Buddha says a fire is extinguished, where does it go? He's pointing to the fact of its subtle state. So when the Buddha says the enlightened state, the enlightened man is like a fire gone out, he's pointing to the deep subtlety of the enlightened man. So the Buddha is urging Vakali to not stop at the outward visible form, to not just go on that, to not even stop with the great qualities that he sees in the Buddha. Vakali needs to see that the nature of the Buddha is reality itself, cosmic, dimensionless. And it's the same for us. All these images and forms, you know, all these paintings in this room, and when we get the Buddha image, the Buddha image that will appear here, these are all doorways, entrances, portals to draw us in to the vast open Dharma, reality itself. As portals and doorways, they are incredibly important. They are invaluable, indispensable, and not to be despised or dismissed as being images for the ignorant, for the less spiritually developed. We cannot afford to do that in the modern West. We really cannot afford to do that. Our education, you know, makes us extraordinarily conceited and to privilege the conceptual over the imaginal. In the know-it-all, even the cynical modern West, we need to meditate on these forms. We need to perform puja. We need to sense these images and feel these images in our consciousness. And at the end, let it all go and have a sense, in a sense, of their real nature, the Dharma reality itself. In Mahayana Buddhism, the deepest nature of the Buddha is called the Dharmakaya, which you could roughly translate as the body of reality, that dimension of the Buddha that is reality. That's the real nature of the Buddha. And in the perfection of wisdom, which is like a diamond, the Diamond Sutra, there is that very famous verse, very similar, in fact, to the Buddha's teaching to Vakali. Those who by my form did see me, and those who followed me by voice, wrong the efforts they engaged in. Me those people will not see. From the Dharma should one see the Buddhas. From the Dharmakaya comes their guidance. Yet Dharma's true nature cannot be discerned, and no one can be conscious of it as an object. We have to remember that this teaching is given to very highly developed individuals, strong in faith and devotion. And we cannot understand the verse without appreciating that. And note the concluding lines. Dharma, truth, reality, cannot be discerned. It can't be turned into an object. It's beyond subject and object. So don't think that an idea, an intellectual construction of reality, emptiness, reality, whatever word you care to use or whatever, is superior to a symbol, an image. In fact, a symbol, an image, a metaphor is probably closer to reality than a concept, because it's more subtle, less graspable. Finally, there's Vakali's death. Vakali, you remember, elects to take his own life. And it's rather shocking to read it. But we need to reflect on what things were like 2,500 years ago. There were no painkillers, no powerful medicines, probably a few herbal remedies. And we know that the bhikkhus relied on a nut dissolved in cow's urine. Seems to have cured everything. I think I had cow's urine once, but anyway, that's another story. Vakali was in terrible pain, overwhelming pain. He was unable to function. So he takes his own life. Generally, in Buddhist tradition, suicide is not approved of. Destroying life is not seen as a good thing. Destroying our own life is not seen as a good thing, because we're probably in a rather negative state. And you're also taking away the possibility of gaining enlightenment and of benefiting others, taking away the great good of human life. But there is a circumstance, according to the ancient tradition, when taking your own life is permissible. When you are liberated, fully liberated from the samsara, from the wheel of life, from conditioned, constructed existence, when your wisdom, your compassion, your purity, your freedom are indestructible, when your creativity is irreversible, then taking your own life, or even giving your life for others out of compassion, if that is the best thing to do, is permissible. But it's not something, of course, that we really want to dwell on, I feel. Life isn't being relinquished because of aversion or depression or despair or impulsively or out of, you know, insanity or something like that. Vakali is fully and completely liberated and cannot be found, cannot be tracked or traced by Mara. Mara is the very personification here of conditioned existence, the samsara, the gravitational pull, as Sangharakshita used to call it. It can't find Vakali. Vakali has transcended all ways of knowing, all ways of telling. You can't describe him as existing, as not existing, as both existing as not, and not existing, neither existing nor not existing. His condition is inconceivable. Vakali's state, his sphere, his realm, all those words in inverted commas, is like that of the Buddha himself, and those wonderful words in the Dhammapada. That enlightened one, whose sphere is endless, whose victory is irreversible, and after whose victory no defilements remain to be conquered, by what track will you lead him astray? The trackless one. By the end of his life, Vakali had truly seen and found the Buddha. By becoming the Buddha, his love for the Buddha had turned in the end, through his practice and through fabulously skillful teaching, had turned into the wisdom of becoming the Buddha. And I'm going to end with Vakali's inspiring words, sang in response to the Buddha when he was in retreat. Keep those words in mind. Let's keep them in mind as we go into our own deep forest grove of the spiritual life. Stricken by sharp stomach pains, you monk, dwelling in the forest grove, where it is harsh and hard to get food, what will you do? Flooding the body with abundant rapture and bliss, and enduring what is harsh, I shall dwell in the grove. Developing the bases of mindfulness, the faculties, the powers, and the factors of enlightenment, I shall dwell in the grove. Recollecting men who are resolute, who put forth energy, constantly firm in effort, who are harmonious and united, I shall dwell in the grove. Recollecting the perfect Buddha, the foremost, the self-tamed, the perfectly composed and concentrated, with untiring effort, both day and night, I shall dwell in the grove.